This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, February 11th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Enough about the candidates. What about the pundits? In November, Nate Silver wrote an article to his colleagues called "Dear Media, Stop Freaking Out About Donald Trump's Polls." Here's Silver on his podcast after Trump's triumph in New Hampshire this week.
Now, that's not to be kind of in denial of the changed facts. I mean, we definitely are way more bullish on Trump's chances than we were a few months ago, even a few weeks ago. But still, people are kind of pre-writing stories based on the presumption now that Trump will win. If you were someone who said, yeah, maybe he can do okay in Iowa and New Hampshire, but we'll have trouble sustaining momentum after that, and then people throw all types of banana peels in his way and he stumbles, then your prediction can still wind up being completely right.
Ben Wallace Wells and Evan Osnos are here to discuss the fate of punditry, given its losing record so far in this election season. Okay, Evan, why have so many political journalists been so wrong? And not just about Trump, obviously. Look at Sanders.
Yeah, I should state at the outset, Dorothy, there is an inherent peril in us here honking off on the subject of punditry. So, listener, beware.
But, I realize that.
So, I mean, I will point out, in defense of punditry, and I'll never say those words again, I do think it's not an entirely new problem. I went back and looked and found that Margaret Thatcher, in fact, in 1975, predicted there would never be a female prime minister in her lifetime. So,
but she was not a pundit. She was a politician.
Fair enough. I guess what I mean is, in a way, there are a lot of reasons why we have really seen a sort of pageant of wrongness over the course of the last few months. If you go back and look, it began before we'd ever even thought about Trump's candidacy. It was about who was going to get in the race. So, of course, people were saying that it was going to be Joe Biden. Of course, Mitt Romney was going to come in and rescue everybody.
Still may happen, Evan.
Still may happen. Early days. Yeah, good point. And not to pile on poor old Nate Silver, but at one point he said that Trump's national following was about as negligible as the share of Americans who believe the Apollo moon landing was faked. And at some point, somebody counted up all of the times that people have declared that Donald Trump is, it's now the beginning of the end, and they found 33 examples from a whole range of different media organizations. So it's not just that one side or another side is guilty. We are all, I'm afraid, making a series of really bad predictions.
So, Ben, I just defend Nate Silver for a minute, and then we won't talk about him anymore. He did correctly forecast the presidential choice in every state in 2012. What is the difference this time for him and for you and everyone who's covering these races?
Well, I think there's a couple things. One thing is we sort of got waylaid by the myth of our own certainty last time around. Nate Silver was a big part of it, but also Sam Wang. There was a big rise in these kind of computational folks who would analyze polls and were just very, very clear that the way to predict elections was a science, not an art. That there were all these reporters and pundits who were out there looking at candidates and their personalities and sort of trying to discern some kind of literary connection or failure to connect with the people. But actually, if you just looked at the polls, you could assemble a very accurate sense of what was going on. And the kind of fascinating thing about this cycle is that that pseudoscientific, stat-driven certainty has broken down. Those guys are just as off as the rest of us. So what's gone wrong? I mean, Trump's gone wrong. Sanders has gone wrong. Those are candidates who are just so far outside of how we thought campaigns should be run, how we thought that popular support sort of coalesced. People just missed. You know, we had gotten into this kind of pseudoscientific way of thinking where we were looking at endorsements and we were looking at the structures of campaigns and we were looking at the ground game. And Trump just comes in and holds a rally in Lowell, Massachusetts, and 8,000 people show up and he gets all this free airtime and goes right over the heads of all that.
But how different is this really? Just recently, 2008, Hillary Clinton was seen as the inevitable candidate. Here she is again, being seen until very recently as the inevitable candidate. There were the same objections to her from voters, and there was Barack Obama quietly paving the way through his grassroots organizations and his social media operation. Why didn't we see a version of this coming again?
I mean, I think part of this is sort of social vanity, you know, like I think we want to presume that the person who's going to be elected president, who other people respect, looks more or less like we do in the media, you know? Barack Obama does and Donald Trump doesn't really and Bernie Sanders doesn't really.
There's an element of geography to this. The reality is a lot of the people who write these stories, ourselves included, live in places like Washington, D.C. and New York. And when you go out to Iowa and New Hampshire, it takes about 5 minutes before you discover that there is this enormous anger out there against politics as a business and as an establishment, and then also against the journalists who are perceived as the handmaidens of that process. And I do think that the seclusion, in effect, of the part of the media that has a big megaphone from what is, in fact, the lived experience on the ground of a lot of Americans mean that we've been caught off guard.
Which is sort of doubly extraordinary because after the Tea Party, we should have had some warning that maybe we're not seeing things
right.
Clearly.
And no offense, you guys, but this is your job to tell us what voters are thinking and worrying about. And in defense, there has been a lot of talk about the anger, but it all seems somewhat abstract. I wanted to ask you, Evan, just in particular about this recent moment with Rubio, which you've written about. And a word of sympathy for you guys. You are on the campaign trail. You often have to file, you know, immediately after an event. So it's kind of understandable that everyone seizes on the most tweetable gaffe. So I noticed this morning, because I tried it, if you Google Rubio now, the first thing that pops up is Rubio robot. Evan, tell us about your response as you were watching that debate and then how you decided to write a web post that would cut through the conventional wisdom a little bit.
A pundit's last resort is to blame the internet. So I'm going to do that for a moment and say that, you know, one of the reasons I think why over the last 8 years or so, as a community of people who think and analyze and talk about politics, why we've become more inclined to get things wrong is that it is even easier to be in the echo chamber. It is far easier than it was when David Broder and his generation were the boys on the bus. I mean, that is so remarkable that you can get online in your house after watching a debate and you can have the perception that you are encompassing the universe of American opinion when in fact you are looking at a set of views of already self-selecting people who agree with you. And so in the case of Rubio, that moment, which really will go down in history as one of the most abrupt either radical stumbles or ends of a candidacy. We'll have to see. I'm boldly not making a prediction, you'll notice. But it happened so fast. The moment consisted of just a few minutes on television. I think the New York Times counted out to less than 3 minutes. And within 24 hours, his entire public perception had changed. And, you know, I was thinking as I was writing this post, what I ended up saying was that, in effect, Rubio has always been tugged between these two impulses, one of which is actually quite dynamic and fleet-footed and charismatic. He is, when you see him on the stump, he is able to be spontaneous. But then his conservatism kicks in, and I don't mean conservatism with a capital C, but his innate tactical political consciousness, which tells him, be careful, because people don't want to fully embrace who you are. You are a young Latino in the beginning of your Senate career. You need to present a safe picture, and you need to, in the end, bang away on the issues that they want you to bang away on. And so what you saw in that moment, which was so fascinating, was that he just reverted to his most conservative political instincts, and it was ruinous, I think.
There was a period of about 12 hours just before the New Hampshire primary when everybody I knew was convinced that Jeb Bush was surging. And it was based on two kind of compelling town halls and Mike Allen posting that all these insiders from Washington were now coming out and now the establishment was like really in for Bush. And there was one poll from Emerson that came out that had him kind of in. And it was in that very, very precise like 12-hour period. It became in my own head like crazy to think that Bush was going to do anything but finish in the top two. That would have been totally implausible like 18 hours earlier, and it became sort of a ridiculous thought 18 hours later. But for whatever reason, that intensity, and I think that's escalated in these particular moments, can really be something.
The other thing I wanted to ask you, Ben, is it true that one explanation for the errors that everyone has been making in terms of predictions is that more people and different people are turning out this time?
At least on the Republican side, I think that's definitely true, yeah. In both Iowa and New Hampshire, we've had record turnout. This is one thing that pollsters and campaign consultants spend a lot of time trying to guesstimate. If the turnout is 20,000 people higher, you know, who does that help? Who does that hurt? At a broader level, we've always had this idiosyncrasy in this country where not that many people actually vote. And so one mystery for political scientists is, like, what would the electorate look like if it was opened up a little bit more, you know, if more people were involved in the process? The general theory is if it was opened up a lot more, it would skew generally to the left. But if it was opened up just a little more, things would just get kind of crazy. you know, mm-hmm. that you have many more radical sort of opinions. I was thinking back to the quote of Nate Silver's that you relayed at the beginning, his assertion that Donald Trump's support was no higher than the amount of Americans who believed in the Apollo moon landing. But you wonder at some level, like, that could be not in consonant with this tremendous surge. You know, there are a fair number of people who believe in the Apollo moon landing.
And, you know, what's interesting, Ben's absolutely right. The structural version of what Ben's just describing, which is the fact that all these new people are coming into the political process, driven in this case by rage and by whatever combination of ingredients Trump is bringing out, that is also a reflection of the structural decline of the party system as a powerful entity. You know,
absolutely.
10, 15 years ago, we all talked about how parties, those were the things, you know, the party decides. That was the watchword. And actually what we've discovered is that the Republican National Committee is being tossed on the waves of populist opinion at the moment. And it seems incapable of not only marshaling the energy to manage the debates in the ways that it wants, but also simply in getting establishment figures, funders, candidates to coalesce around a shared set of ideas and strategies. And as a result, it finds itself totally outmatched by the will of the public.
We're seeing this version of the same thing among the Democrats, too. I mean, look at Bernie Sanders and look at Hillary's inability to deal nimbly with the surge that he is experiencing.
Yeah, and Hillary's got a bubble problem of her
totally.
Own.
Totally.
One thing that's interesting about the Democrats is there's kind of an institutional collapse story there, too. So the story for Hillary was always she has the support of many, many black and Hispanic elected leaders. She has the lined-up support of the labor unions, you know. And so these constituencies that don't look like her personally might not naturally be her target area. There should be, you know, a kind of ability of those groups to pull in voters. I'm not so sure that's happening anymore. You know, you see, particularly with labor unions, these worries that Donald Trump will eat into their support. And you have to wonder whether after Occupy Wall Street and after Black Lives Matter and with a more grassroots sensibility in the left generally, you have to wonder if that kind of sensibility will hold.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Evan, one thing I've noticed is that readers and viewers who follow politics are subject every 4 years to journalistic jargon, along with the candidates' endlessly repeated stump speeches. Actually, come to think of it, everybody's robotic in this sense. What else are you hearing out there on the campaign trail where your colleagues are just endlessly cycling through the same standard spiels?
You know, I was overseas for 11 years writing about foreign stuff and then come back to the United States and write about politics. And I'll tell you, there is something that is noticeably different, which is that when you talk about politics in some cases, there is a strange embedded reward for hewing to the conventional wisdom. If you go too far outside of what everybody already thinks, then people write off the idea. If you had said 9 months ago or a year ago, Donald Trump is going to eradicate the idea of lanes, and he's going to exploit this incredible populist energy, please put me on television, you would have been laughed out.
You know, like, one thing that's been interesting to me is as much crap as the general media has gotten for kind of a pro-Rubio position in the Republican primaries, it's so, so much worse on Fox News.
I wanted to ask you guys about Fox, which is that's been one of the biggest spectacles of the campaign.
It has, and they're completely in the bag for Rubio. After Iowa, it was just praise rolling on down about, you know, this magnificent third place finish that was going to turn around the campaign. The position of the pundit is sort of a weird and idiosyncratic one. It's sort of half part of the party apparatus, half journalistic, kind of quasi-independent, but still connected. And I don't know, it's just felt, especially watching Fox News, but watching the whole class across this primary, particularly as they've watched the Republicans, that there's just this kind of deep yearning for it to please be true, that there still exists an establishment lane, that John Kasich still matters.
Fox is having this very interesting moment. This is their 20th year on the air. It was predicted that they would never succeed as a news channel. It was seen as Rupert Murdoch's folly. And, of course, the history has turned out to be much more interesting. I think the fact that doesn't often get talked about is that the Trump-Megyn Kelly rivalry, and you should probably call it the Trump-Megyn Kelly-Roger Ailes rivalry, has turned into a bonanza for everybody involved and has been hugely successful. Fox has had one of its best years ever, if not its best year, in terms of ratings and revenue. But there's another side of this, which is if you look at Morning Joe, and so Joe Scarborough used to be a congressman from Florida, hosts a show on MSNBC, and he was relentlessly critical of Marco Rubio, and yet he was also enormously interested and supportive of Donald Trump's candidacy. And the New York Times picked up on this and wrote a piece the other day. But there are these venues where they can go and get essentially unmediated opportunities to say whatever it is they want on the air.
I want to end by asking both of you, maybe start with you, Evan. We are, and we've touched on this throughout this discussion, we are witnessing a really powerful set of social movements on the right and the left. And it's been building for a while. We saw the Tea Party beginning in 2009. Black Lives Matter is getting stronger all the time. How do you, as reporters who are covering this on a daily basis, step back and try to put it in perspective?
I find that the experience of the last 6 months of watching how many times we have been incredibly surprised is a reminder of how much we really don't know about the state of mind and the state of the electorate. And it is really true that 24 hours spent on the ground in South Dakota is worth about 6 weeks in your office in Washington. What you learn by simply reporting, by going out and talking to people and write down what they say, I mean, the most old-fashioned form of political analysis is in its own way, even though this is a campaign season, we're supposed to have all these reporters everywhere, that is in relatively short supply because people are more inclined to say, okay, I have a hypothesis, I'm now going to go out and essentially market my hypothesis rather than go out and find evidence that challenges my assumptions. Donald Trump is the clearest evidence of that. There are all of these people out there who, if you asked the right question or you found them at the right moment, would have said to you something that should have exploded your conception of how the 2016 campaign was going to go.
The Sanders miss is even a more pointed problem, you know, because there the issue isn't that you're cloistered in some section of the country or forgetting that white working class people exist. It's that you're like talking to the parents and not the kids. You're talking to the older, more established sibling and not the younger, more adventuresome one.
But we saw the Occupy movement. Yeah. We saw the Elizabeth Warren surge when everyone in that part of the party really wanted her to run for office. And she was talking about exactly the same things that Sanders is talking about. Did we just kind of forget about that moment and then think, well, Bernie Sanders, he's this Jewish older guy from Brooklyn. You know, he doesn't have a prayer. He's a socialist.
I think we do tend to undercount ideology and overcount personality and charm. Marco Rubio, a kind of classic example here. I think if Elizabeth Warren had run and she had had probably more or less the same spiel that Bernie Sanders did, I think there would have been a lot more attentiveness to the possibility of a phenomenon there than there was with Sanders. I think Sanders as a human being had sort of been written off as a batty old uncle for so long that it just seemed impossible.
Okay, thank you both. Evan Osnos and Ben Wallace Wells are staff writers. Ben's work has been collected in the Best American Political Writing, and Evan is the author of Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. This is The Political Scene. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.
You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts in the iTunes Store. The weekly audio edition of The New Yorker is available at audible.com.